Okay, let me get started with Rabbi Wurzburger. We last left off with meta-halachic principles. Another important essay of Rabbi Wurzburger is his essay on the oral law. He will change the discourse of how you criticize the conservative movement. In his book review of Boaz Cohen, who is a right-wing conservative rabbi, Talmudist, he will write that the legalists of JTS make a distinction between their historic research and the logic of their heart. Because if something is only historic, then it has no binding force today. Rather philosophic argument. Meaning because in American philosophy, history isn't binding the way it is in Hegelian philosophy. He finds it illegitimate to compare the changes of Zacharia Frankel to the changes of Yitzhak Elchanan. But his real philosophic argument is when a figure like Boaz Cohen criticizes Chazal for making up something new, he says either they knew they were changing the law or they were naive and didn't know they were distorting the law. If they knew they were changing the law, then the law is not true. And if they were naive, then we shouldn't follow them. Hence, philosophically, he says they can't be changing the law for us still to be following them. Yes. Meaning, Wurzburger is going to make it into a all-or-nothing philosophic change, hold on, between the conservative movement and Orthodox. He will then say that the question is not about the nature of the changes in Chazal between right-wing conservative and Orthodox. But the question is whether the changes were part of Har Sinai or the Har Sinai process. Many changes are part of the Har Sinai from Har Sinai, while other changes are part of the process. And this is where he introduces the words, it's a Torah Chaim, there's a halachic process, there's Elu ve'Elu. Yes, human beings have subjectivity, but they still follow an objective halachic process. See, over and over again, the new answer we're going to have is the difference between conservative and Orthodox will be the conservative are not following a halachic process. They are treating it as human subjectivity, while halacha has a process. He's going to say that halacha was not adapting to the times, but only applying. And he will introduce the word chidushei Torah. Chidushei Torah were there right from the start, and that's how he's going to explain the rabbinic statements about where Rabbi Akiva went beyond Moshe, that it was a process of Chidushei Torah being part of the process. He's not going to, unlike us now, when we hear a statement like that, do you mean the Ran, do you mean the Maharal, do you mean the Netziv, whose position of Chidushei Torah are we talking about? But the point is, he was the first one to even introduce into this rhetoric that classic distinction. He also introduces the idea that the Masorah has multiple meanings. Hold on. He says, yes, things have to respond to their own given times. Hirsch is not correct. Judaism is not just eternal. But it's a halachic process that is eternal. That's the crucial line here, an eternal halachic process. And And there is no pshat drush distinction, but a continuous halachic process. And then in the end, he comes back and says, we are not bound by our hearts, but bound by duty. The conservative movement chooses Pascal over Kant. Kant is now going to be seen as a good person, where it's the exact opposite of the Chabad argument. Yes, there was a hand or two up. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Why is it that things like you've had many different approaches to the historical Holocaust and approach to Judaism within modern Orthodoxy? Why is it that all of them think that finally after God has modified the law as a bad thing and that impugned the Orthodoxy? Why does it always have to be that even if we accept historical conclusions because we see a great unity behind it, or we don't accept historical conclusions at all, or rather,
because Rabbi Wurzburger is going to be openly saying history is only one method of understanding the world around us. I choose a philosophic one instead. That's right. Yes, there's a hand on this side. Yes.
Can you look at some of the early innovations that are causing
what was it in the 1920s? That I'm not opening because that's a real kettle of fish. Because in the 1920s, permitting grape juice instead of wine for Kiddush was only by followers of Solomon Schechter. I mean, the halachic arguments of the 20s and 30s are much finer line. It's only 53, 54 when it was clearly driving to shul is a clear break. Huh? 53. However, to use grape juice instead of Kiddush wine is a different sort of argument. Yes. Here? He's taking it into, it's no longer about specific changes, it's the fact that you're not part of the halakhic process anymore. And that becomes it's no longer a big issue, it's the global issue, and now say they're not followers of the oral law because they don't have the process. Because where in 45 you had to get involved, what about this issue, what about that issue, now it becomes a categorical. Yes? He is going, part of his, since his essays are all so short, he is going to, in his 8 pages, tell you these are our points. There's a halachic process. There is Chidushei Torah, Chidushei Torah application. He will not at all present you the debates between the Ramban, the Ran, the Ritva, the Maharal on Chidushei Torah. He just puts it out there and...
But normally a lot of conservatives stop and say, this is where it just regards.
No. It becomes across the board opinion. Yes?
What are there also issues which Orthodox leaders have with
Okay, so the answer is yes, they always objected to the curriculum of the seminary, but the halakhic questions were all in 1925 were all of the mild sort. You know, were the things, for example, that at the seminary they permit carrying a walking stick on Shabbos.
Would you say that?
Which was permitted by European Jewry anyway.
Right. So would you say that in hindsight, some of the
Some yes, some no. That's the whole problem of Hirschinson. Some yes, some no.
The method,
probably in 1925 it was not the method, but by 1955 it certainly was the method. Yes.
You said there's no Pshat Drash distinction, it's all part of the process.
Yeah.
How does that work? The Drash is halachic.
Yeah.
How does that play?
See, that's very much the Rav. Meaning that, you know, you are part of the halachic process. And Drash is just, you know, your more of your rhetoric. But it's still, and then your bottom line is halacha. But there's no real distinction.
But then you say that he brings in change through the ideal process. So why are they not part of the plan?
Yeah.
And it doesn't answer it. Okay. Is there an implicit assumption that it's obvious that what it is?
Yes, it's pretty obvious.
So what are, can you explicate these?
The answer is, if Boaz Cohen says that the rabbis made up halacha X under the influence of Roman law, that's very different than saying Rabbi X understood the biblical verse through Midrash Halacha to mean Y.
Does that mean that naming names that there might be certain teachers who presently have the same opinion that Wurzburg would categorize as conservative?
I'm not sure. It's a little oblique, but possibly. It means what? The answer is, it becomes a categorical that you cannot say that it was due to Greco-Roman influence or Persian influence or any other influence.
But there's attraction, but that attraction was not fundamental.
It was not fundamental. It's the same way we're Americans, but the fact that Rav Schechter is an American or Bleich is an American and you understand this halacha a certain way is not fundamentally biased the halachic process.
And also, this is just, I guess, to what extent did he talk to and interact with Berkowitz and other Orthodox scholars? Like, to what extent was he part of some sort of mix of American?
The answer is Rabbi Wurzburger was the closest to the Rav. So it has the most of the Rav within it.
Did he talk?
Oh yeah, they all knew each other personally. They all, yeah.
So, do you
find
anything that's common between the?
No, because he wrote his own, for better or worse. Okay, and then I really must go on. Yes.
He said that he was the closest to Rav. All right, a lot. So we say the most, the philosophical thing of knowledge.
At this time, it's certainly Rabbi Wurzburger.
For all time.
You can't do that. Wurzburger in his essay Alienation and Exile denies all the modern theories saying that Judaism is about being exiled or about being alienated from the world. He'll reject Will Herberg, Arthur Cohen, Milton Conant, almost anyone who says Judaism is a Hannah Arendt, anyone who says Judaism is a life of exile. Meaning from the Western culture, and that's who we should be. He quotes from Soloveitchik in a speech from 1954, where Soloveitchik explains Maimonides' doctrine of the golden mean as the same as the tension between Chesed and Gevura in the Kabbalah, in that the golden mean is not prudence of a business person, but the golden mean means the mediation of the extremes within human life. And Wurzburger coincidentally notes that Tillich in his book Love, Power and Justice in 54 said the same thing, but without the Jewish terminology.
Is there any indication that
Salvation
do that?
Hmm?
Is there any indication that?
Yeah. Holiness is not alienation. Mitzvot are in this world. Halacha is not pro-galus. He'll have a number of very short essays continuing with this, because this he would get up often and critique a lot of the secular Jewish intellectuals. Wurzberger held there is no commanding voice of Auschwitz. There is no Holocaust theology to be made. We only have a commanding voice of Sinai. He also would quote Rav Soloveitchik as not seeing a messianic element within the state, a divine providential element, but not a messianic one. His essay on interfaith dialogue, which got recently reprinted in the last issue of the paper, which I think has a few typos in it, because it doesn't match my... I have a whole thing in my computer, because I refer to that speech often, yeah, to the Synagogue Council of America. So I think there are a few little changes from whichever version that one's taken from. The Green Book? Yeah, okay. So there's some I went... Just, I did a few quick Google search and didn't match some of the prepositions. So one or both of us have got a few prepositions wrong in the transcriptions. But his article on interfaith, remember Berkowitz was against interfaith. So Wurzberger in the article on interfaith says orthodoxy is not about moral isolationism, not against ghettoization. We have to be involved in the social, political, and economic issues of our times. We are not secular, even when we go into the secular realm. We are arguing from our sense of being divine beings and our divine imperatives. But Judaism and Christianity are two separate faith communities. Yes, the Rambam already pointed out how Christianity accepts the Bible, but Islam doesn't. And the Be'er HaGolah points out how Christians, just like us, accept God, creation, and Yetziat Mitzrayim. And they reject the Avodah Zarah. They have an impure idea of the divine, Shituch, but they are not Avodah Zarah. But we reject Franz Rosenzweig's giving Christians a special role. Even if, now this is an interesting point. He'll quote the Rambam, says the Rambam, where the Rambam and the uncensored versions of Hilchot Malachim says that Christianity and Islam bring knowledge of God to the world. He'll cite it. He implies that he doesn't agree because Christianity cannot be part of our covenant. Next, there are those out there who think confrontation with Christianity will confirm and purify our own faith. On the other hand, it's equally bad that there are those people who try to make Jewish categories the exact opposites of Christian categories, who play up the differences between Christianity and Judaism, even when they are the same. We have to steer a middle course and be honest about what we share and what we differ with.
And not discuss those things?
No, he didn't say not discuss those things. Derail this into other issues. Thank you. Please. We can't listen to the ultimate concern that Christians have. We can't try to understand the Trinity. They shouldn't try to understand our understanding of Har Sinai. The highest element of truths are not universal, but particular. There's no one essence of religion. Finally, on intergroup relations, it may not bring us closer. It actually may heighten our differences. Finally, in interfaith activities, we should take part in them. We have to be actively engaged in the secular realm. But we are not entering a secular people. We are entering a secular people speaking the language of God. To put that in other words, you now in the recently published letters of Soloveitchik that came out 2 months ago, you see the Rav did not want discussions about Trinity, God, messianism, and the ultimate meaning of religion. But there was no problems for having discussions about the sanctity of man or any of our religious ethics or Yetziat Mitzrayim, which we don't differ on, or the fact that God has a miraculous role in the natural order. It was only the things that we truly diverge are the things we can't talk about. And Rabbi Wurzberger, from his continuous role as the interfaith representative for Rav Soloveitchik, you know, certainly said you could talk about Talmud Torah and Tshuva and those things rather than being comparisons or theologic dialogue. It's really just showing our contrasts. And now I'll take quick questions that are germane to Rabbi Wurzberger and not to contemporary issues.
Things
that are human religious element that are common to the human religious experience. That's right. That's right. That I specifically remember because in 1983 he had just come back from speaking someplace in the Midwest at someplace, and you know, I was always his little follower asking him questions from then at this point, and he says, you know, some of my colleagues don't understand. The Rav had nothing against us presenting, you know, our views of tshuva. It's what we can't do is do comparison and contrast of our views, but a self-presentation, you know, that highlights our differences was not the problem.
Did he ever comment either from self or the Rav on Congress and what that process was?
No. For modern Orthodoxy, conversion was not an issue. Christians were not converting into Orthodoxy, and Orthodox Jews were not converting out. It was more likely a liberal Jew converting out.
Well, not socially, but theologically.
Theologically, conversion was not an issue on the modern Orthodox. Modern Orthodoxy was still very ethnic, urban identity, in which if you couldn't understand what a bagel was or a kasha knish was, you really weren't a member of the tribe. Meaning, so your whole framing of it was very nuts. If you didn't understand the corned beef sandwich with celery soda, you really weren't Jewish still.
That point
is that you don't have that same ethnic identity that used to be in. Yes?
Yeah. And he says how
Perchowski says that often
when engaged in Christian Jewish dialogue, we're bound to some people on some of the uncommitted Jews on the periphery. And it seems to me from Perchowski's perspective that would be fine. And Wurzberger quotes this when he was worked by saying, oh no, but
it's not going to happen.
Certainly prefer a second Jew to remain and have not been a believer of Christianity. So, like,
the answers, they were theoretical at that time. Okay? Right now, that's a real issue because the head of the Protestant World Council of Churches, one of the people behind divestment, is a converted Jew who lives here in the Heights. Meaning, so then already we're talking contemporary issues, and then it's a different course. You know, I can give you a lot of detail.
But from a horse for his own perspective, to bring in what the reform perspective, not so much to say how we are the correct thing, but to say, oh, do you think what the reform is saying is better?
Wait, he's only debating reform. There are no real converts in the room at that point.
Okay.
There are now. Now we live in a much more eclectic age in which you will find a lot of European converts to Christianity from Judaism, and a lot of now Christians who became Jews through Israel, in which the borders between the groups are much more complex. Okay, and like I said, I can give a course on that next year, but that's really not our topic for today. Most importantly is ethics. Walter Wurzburger instilled in all this, you must be ethical. So if you were to come to him, and if Mr. Pepper here in the room would just say that he just loved Meir Kahane's speech, Walter Wurzburger would absolutely condemn it, that you don't understand your divine imperatives to be just. That was the sort of he also used to call on us by name. It would be like, you know, always, if Mr. Blickstein were to murder Mr. Pepper, would that be ethical? You know, he would always give you enough fodder for walking out of who's committing what crime against who in the current class to laugh about. Always been on the
smoking would be considered unethical to yourself.
He would bring that up also. You know, that kind of came up also. No, it was very deontological, utilitarian. It was the older categories. His book, Ethics of Responsibility, takes many of his shorter articles, including Covenantal Imperatives, Law is Not Nomos, and others, and rewrites them into a readable narrative. So he opens up saying, Halacha is not law. Halacha is our way to God. Halacha bedrachav. We do not have an ethic of obedience. Okay, bear that in mind, because when we get to centrism, we'll find a lot of thinkers that'll say we have an ethic of obedience. We don't have an ethic of obedience, but our human experience instead wants us to have an ethical virtues. And Wurzburger's phrase is intuitive ethical beliefs. Intuitive ethical beliefs. And he's going to believe those things are pluralistic. We have chiyuvim for chesed, mishpat, din, shalom, emet, rachamim, love, justice, truth, peace. And you've got to learn intuitively how to apply them. Halacha is certainly the will of God, and you don't deviate from it. Let me finish what I'm saying. And we accept the binding authority of halacha as given by an interpreter. But there are numerous ways to apply it. Halacha is in the hands of these intuitive ethical beliefs that the Baal Halacha has to use their intuition about knowing which of these human categories to apply. And in this he will cite Bernard Williams' critique of Kantian ethics, that ethics is about ought, not is. Therefore, ethics is not about facts. Halacha may be about facts, but ethics, since it's about ought, is intuitive ethical judgments. Intuitive ethical judgments found in the nature of the halachic system. Let him explain himself before you jump on questions. Bernard Williams. So we make value judgments from specific historic cultural situations. We have an intuitive faculty that intuits a universal divine moral obligation. So besides the fact of halakha, we have an intuition of our moral obligations. So if you, Mr. Pepper, were going after Meir Kahana, he would say, you are defective in your Torah intuition. You are lacking in the ethical, covenantal imperative of the Torah. He will say he's not Buber and Rosenzweig, who believe there has to be a separate revelation, that Mr. Pepper has to have a revelation of the covenant in order to be ethical. No, it's an intuitive faculty that Mr. Pepper would be lacking if he wasn't ethical. He's going to say, is Judaism ethical? Certainly Hillel and Rabbi Akiva and Shaddal and Achara Am and Levi Nas all saw it that way. And ethics is not limited to Judaism. Many non-Jews share our ethical concerns. And his basis for it will be Sadia Gaon. When Sadia Gaon says there are mitzvot sichliot. And mitzvot sichliot are known by this intuitive quality. He will quote Rav Soloveitchik's Kol Dodi Dofek pre-publication, saying that we don't just have a Sinai covenant, we also have an Abrahamic covenant. And the Abrahamic covenant includes our ideals, our values, our ethics, our vision, our faith, our experiences, and it's not just all the halacha of Sinai. Judaism includes an Abrahamic covenant, and this is somewhat similar to Shaddal. And he argues already on page 15 of the book, halacha is not coextensive with Jewish ethics. No! Halacha barely touches Jewish ethics at all. To think that all Jewish ethics is in the halacha is absurd. And he'll cite all these cases about, you know, just the last one of the sequences is the Aruch HaShulchan, when the Aruch HaShulchan says that Kibud Av V'Em has to be accepted as an ethical principle, not because of a duty to truly be Kibud Av V'Em. I mean, he'll cite these lots of cases in which where of course things are not obedience and duty, but are completely about a certain value, ethic, experience, ideal. He says that Judaism has no need for the Kierkegaardian suspension of the ethical, because Judaism is ethical. And in some place where you think it's not ethical, since all commands are consequential, then that unethical act really must be ethical and you just don't see it. A very Rav Sadia Gaon type of answer. Or Rambam type answer. All mitzvot are truly rational and ethical, like the Rambam says, even if it appears as a hoax to you. But we certainly don't affirm any Kierkegaardian suspension of the ethical. Judaism is not non-ethical in any way. Is there an intrinsic Jewish ethic? Is there a reason that Mr. Pepper should, as a Jew, have this intuition? This is what really works for Easter to do in class. You got the point after. And the more you drove it home, the more he kept going after you. Is there an intrinsic Jewish ethic? The Ramban talks about Asita HaTov HaYashar. You always have to do the good and the right. And therefore the halacha is not everything, but there are higher values you strive for. The Netziv talks about the need to be Yashar and Kedoshim under changing conditions. Albo talks about how, in Sefer Karin, how the halacha has to be applied ethically to ever new conditions. It's not an autonomous ethic. No. It is the same divine ethic like we see in Sadia and Bachya and Rambam and Hirsch. There is a inner voice that tells us to be ethical. He's going to say, Bachya was right. We have hovo to levavot. We have duties of the heart, which Wurzburger translates as conscience. We have to follow our conscience. And our conscience is cultivated through halachic life. The conscience will help us discover the divine will. He continues in chapter 2 and says, it's a good thing that there is no halacha on most political, social, and ethic concerns, because this leaves us space for an ethical life. Because an ethical life, in many ways, is, can be much more sensitive than the law. The law is the law, it's torts, it's civil law, but truly we're very thankful that there's such a large place for ethics. And that large place, he's going to call our covenantal imperatives, underline, trademark, brand name. And the covenantal imperatives are not inferences from the law and don't have to be footnoted to the law, but are immediately intuited. In this, he quotes from Soloveitchik, saying that the halacha should only be a floor, but not a ceiling, of your ethical activities. It's the baseline, not the limit of what makes you ethical. You cannot be another Bershut HaTorah. Wurzburger then says, yes, I've learned a lot from reading Buber's Life of Dialogue. Yes, just like Buber, I agree that we are addressed by God to the needs of the hour. But we're against Buber's antinomianism, where Buber thought the law wasn't needed, and Tillich thought the law wasn't needed, and Kant thought the law wasn't needed. For us, the halacha is our training ground and sometimes our concretization of these ethical imperatives. He also says, don't think that Rav Soloveitchik or I were teaching a doctrine of Das Torah, because these intuitions are available to everybody. They are individual, they are subjective, and they are personal responsibility. We all have to learn how to deal with these rules, how to deal with the particular versus general, how to deal with conflicts. Judaism is not act morality, meaning it's not whether you do an act, whether you're Yotze Zayin, whether you've done it, but it's agent morality. It's who you are as a person, whether you are an ethical person or not. And in this he reiterates, besides Hillel, besides the Ramban, the Marashah, the Netziv, and others, in his reading, this is going to be the Rav too, that the Rav believed Jewish ethics were Mahu Afata, based on the Rambam in Mor Nevuchim, not anything formal. Judaism believes in concepts like Darche Shalom, And there's social utility in Darkei Shalom dealing with Gentiles. And this he's going to cite Rambam Sadia, the Tur, the Meshech Chachma. He's going to reject Rav David Tzvi Hoffman's book on Darkei Shalom. As being apologetic, because David Tzvi Hoffman said these were part of the law rather than intuition. I, meaning now I'm talking, there's a clear misconversation, is because in Germany David Tzvi Hoffman believed all law has to be value grounded, that they have a ground norm to be German social law, while in America, since all law at that time was positive law, ethics are in the realm of intuition, for Walter Wurzberger. Also, that for Wurzberger, he doesn't really care if any Eastern European responsa contradicts his view. Meaning, if he can show you that Sadia or the Rambam necessitate this ethic, it doesn't boil down to Maram Shek versus a Shavus Yaakov about how to treat a Gentile. It becomes an ethical imperative in your life. It doesn't become having to then be slavish to other historic social situations. He is against, Judaism is who you are, not just what you do, so he is against orthopraxy. Okay, very important. Very anti-orthopraxy. And that's what we learned from Heschel about you, who reacted strongly against the sense of orthopraxy we're seeing around him. And you've got to cultivate a state of mind, as Rav Soloveitchik said, Yitziat Mitzrayim is a continuous state of faith. Or as the Shmona Parakim say, ethics are based on your habituation. He's going to explain Yeshuvo Shel Olam as character traits. He will conclude that section about anti-orthoprax with Rav Moshe Cordovero and how Moshe Cordovero and Tomar Devora advocated altruism, forbearance, patience, divine humility, all within the context of our Olam Hazeh lives being filled with the divine. Finally, Judaism is not Kantian categorical. Judaism is filled with intuitions, plurality, casuistry. He believes that we find the ethical within our particular, not within the universal. Therefore, when Hermann Cohen argued against Zionism, because since Zionism was particular, therefore you couldn't have universal Jewish ethics in a particular. Walter Wurzberger gives the same answer, that almost the same answer that Levinas gives. We find our universal within the particular of our own lives, families, countries. He derived it independently, but it does the same. I mean, you can see the early article from the 50s. And the article, the printed book from the 80s, where he then footnotes, you know, Levinas, you know, came up now with this idea also. And
oh, so you read Levinas?
Till the last weeks of his life, Rabbi Wurzburger kept up on all fields of ethics, philosophy, and what was going on. Unlike people who are half their age that are already out of date, Rabbi Wurzburger was up to date till the end of his life, meaning you could ask him the latest issue of ethics philosophy and social affairs, and he would be up to date in the reading. Yes? Yes.
Would that comprise, would he conceive that it would comprise, say, a worldview?
The answer is yes, but not from that source. That's part of the attraction about why the meta-halacha of Wurzburger gets used for the study of halacha, because unlike using Dilthe or Weber or Mannheim as the values within law, he's coming from the intuitionist school of early 20th century ethics. His doctorate was in ethics, and he's coming from early 20th century Anglo-American intuitionism, even if there's a wonderful convergence. Okay? He knows it. He's fluent in German, too. And he's born in Germany, and he did his doctorate in Brentano long before it was translated. There is something there, but where Wurzburger was influenced by Dilthe or Weber is a question. Okay? Yes?
Did he ever respond to postmodern conceptions of ethics?
Who's a postmodern? And people use that word indiscriminately to almost anybody. Give me a name and I'll tell you. The answer is he would reject Foucault as too much of a Nietzschean. Judaism does not believe in the intuition of a will to power. Huh? No. He would not have. Not that he hadn't read it, but he would have said, we believe that is already a secular ethic. The same way he had already rejected Camus and Sartre as already being too individual and not a divine imperative, Derrida doesn't offer him any more divine grounding.
Does he have written responses?
Yes, he's got written responses. He would be more concerned with having to deal with. Let me try to think. What would he would still be concerned with now dealing with people like McIntyre. Were people who want, or people who wanted to go back to Aristotle and Aquinas, were people who he was concerned with. To say that you're completely secular interested him less. Okay, he was interested in formulations, meaning since deconstruction doesn't really have an ethic per se, meaning it doesn't go back and reformulate how does agent versus act morality work. It interested him less. So, but he would be interested in all the scholarship on Hume, Mill, Locke, on ethics, and kept up on the articles as they came out.
Did he ever respond to the Levinas and Korkovitz? Has he ever had a response to that?
No. Yes.
Maybe a little bit of a simpler question, on the one hand, the ethics modulates Halakha, and on the other hand, the ethics transcends Halakha.
Okay, let me see if the last points may clarify it a little bit more. You guys cut me off before I got to the point is Rabbi Wurzburger was a liberal and one of the few signers on most political statements searching for peace in the Middle East. Unlike many of his colleagues, he would always be on all the peace activist statements. He writes on page 106 of his book that Reb Soloveitchik was the opposite of Reb Chaim of Volozhin, and that they are very different Personally, he told me, if you want to understand the godless of the Rav, go visit Brisk in Yerushalayim, which I did, and saying, you see the difference. Meaning, he really made a disjunctive between the two. Because where Reb Chaim may have been creativity only in Torah, the Rav's worldview also believed in harnessing nature, human dignity, enhancing human welfare, being part of social responsibility, and having ethical concerns where halacha is the floor, not the ceiling. So where Chaim of Brisk said, don't learn Chovat Levavos, and certainly don't read the pages where Chovat Levavos, where Bachya makes fun of the jurist who knows Gittin but doesn't know Chovat Levavos, doesn't know ethics. In Wurzberger's presentation, the Rav believed in ethics and believed in a whole world outside of the halacha. Centrists do not have that same reading of the Rav. Rav Wurzberger says Rav Hirsch, Rav Soloveitchik, Rav Cook were all open to the values of modernity. They were all open to human responsibility. They all wanted to get us outside of the walls of the ghetto and to really be able to be part of the world. Questions? Yes. You like this thing. Yeah? I was at Rabbi Wurzberger Chassid when I was here. And I took everything I could, including I took a guided reading with him in advanced ethics, so that, like, everything he had read in the prior 5 years, just to know where his thought patterns were. So that's how I could answer your questions, because I remember what we read on that. Right. That's right.
So does he ever respond to women's issues, to a lot of women, like that whole agenda?
In that, he probably just punted at that point in his life, because it didn't become an issue until the very end, and not in his own congregation, which had gone the other direction. So he was spared from answering that, because his congregation went to the right.
What was his congregation?
Shar Tzvila. Okay. Now we move on into the 60s, a whole new unit. Yes?
Sure. The idea of intuition, was that like a preconceived notion of the ethical or based on empirical human experience?
Both. But that's where we would actually talk to him about, you know, this we get from G.E. Moore, the intuitionism, this is now the Persian sense data. I mean, that's where you can talk to him about the various elements within his theory.
But he doesn't think it was planted in our mind, so to speak, like ethical intuition.
I mean, are we hardwired for it?
Something like that, yeah.
He tended to avoid the biological metaphors. Yeah, I think he considered biological metaphors, just like historic metaphors, as a category mistake. He liked to think that from is to ought there is no passage, following Hume, and therefore following Bernard Williams from Harvard, therefore ought is completely independent of all is's. To say you are hardwired is already an is. There's a sharpness to his thinking that's, you know, it's not just homiletics. He had a real...
Yeah.
What?
No, it's very sharp.
Yeah. Yes.
When you try to make any psychological observation, what do you think say that any is cannot be generalized?
Hume.
In the frame is, he's not following the story of other people, except for not as though he has a response to history.
No, he's coming from the fact that Sadhya was not a historical thinker, Rambam wasn't, the Nitziv wasn't, the Ramban wasn't. The answer is Yehuda Halevi. Yehuda Halevi is no, because Yehuda Halevi is conspicuously absent in his canon. Krochmal is conspicuously absent in his canon, meaning it is clearly Sadhya, Bachya, Rambam, Herman Cohen, Shadal, Hirsch. His canon clearly, Yehuda Halevi is not there. Maharal is not there. A lot of the historic elements of Krochmal and the Mitzvah are not there. The 60s. Okay, please let me get this out and please jump ahead in this one. In this we are going to deal with the stories of how the 60s came to be, how Yitz Greenberg pushed things open, how it then led to a response from Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, how the Jewish Observer got involved, how then by the end of this process we now have a winnowing out of a lot of the ideas of modern orthodoxy out of the picture, and then eventually how a lot of the Jewish Observer authors became future editors of tradition and Jewish action. Okay. So, let's once upon a time. Charles Liebman, who was a young poli-sci professor here, wrote a document on the varieties of orthodoxy. It was circulating in 63, got published in 64, commissioned by Gertrude Himmelfarb, and then came out in full version in 70. Know that during this time period, Charles Liebman was a poli-sci professor. Gerald Blitzstein was teaching Chazal here. David Hartman was teaching here. Yitz Greenberg was teaching here. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein was teaching here, and Professor Louis Feldman was doing very creative course team teaching. Meaning, a lot of these people team taught with each other. For example, Charles Liebman and Rav Aaron Lichtenstein team taught. Rav Liebman and Emanuel Rachman team taught. Meaning, this was an era. Now, in the 63 essay that got published in 64, Charles Liebman evaluated the state of our orthodoxy, and he talked about the different groups that are out there, you know, the isolationists, the yeshivish, those who don't deal with issues, and what he called the self-conscious intellectuals who are the future of Judaism. Okay, so we now have him putting out as a young professor basically saying the future is in Berkowitz's and Yitz Greenberg's and company's hands. Okay. This continues to snowball because there really is a sense a fervent that is going on briefly. It has come out in some of the Judaica articles about that moment when we had, you know, we went to Rav Lichtenstein for Shir, and then we had Louis Feldman team teaching with Rachman one course, and Charles Liebman and Ritz Gimbert team teaching another course, and we were, you know, going to embrace the modern era in every way. You have a lot of that sort of 64 reminiscences that is coming out of Judaica. And that's the start of the story. In 1966, the commentator interviews Yitz Greenberg, who at that point was the rabbi of RJC. He was the founder of the of SAR, meaning he merged Akiva and Salanter and created a bigger institution from it. He was the teacher of the first Holocaust course in America, and a major rabbinic player. Commentator will interview him peacefully in 66, and that interview is going to now start. It's going to set off a catechismic reaction that we are going to be talking about today and next class, and if we're lucky, we won't have to be talking about it next week also. He says that we have a covenant with God. As we learn from Noah, God walks with man. We also learn from, and from Abraham and Moses, we learn about the halacha. There's an importance of realizing we have responsibility in the separate covenant with God. Yes, he believes that orthodoxy is the most committed, and he believes in orthodoxy. But modern Judaism has been shattered, and we have to take reform, conservative, and secular seriously. Okay, we need to have a more open attitude. Judaism lives in the temporal and needs to respond to events. We can learn even from the conservative movement how they are creating new Taimei HaMitzvot for our age. We have to understand that in the modern era, we can no longer... Now, point number one is we live in a democratic age. We have a democratic Judaism. We can't put down Goyim anymore. Point number two, we have to embrace new fields like biblical criticism and truly articulate what do we mean by divine revelation. Three, we have to re-examine the Shulchan Aruch. We have to see how we can bring holiness into the mundane. And he thinks post-scheme are not quick enough to respond. What do we do about Vietnam, the welfare state, poverty? If we look at the laws of wars, Hilchot Malachim, we should be advocating peace. We should condemn massacres. How do we really know what to do in Vietnam? Our post-game are not posking Vietnam for us. Fight on poverty. How should we respond to Kennedy's Great Society? At this point, it was LBJ's continuation of Great Society. But furthermore, we now live in a material age with consumerism, ads, and television. Eric Fromm, as the psychologist, has pointed out how manufacturers take away our free will and image of God with their manipulation of our drives and wants. What should be the Jewish response? Now the big one. Halacha is not addressing modern sexuality. Okay, let me finish how he phrases this, because the legal question will rest on what the next few sentences say. He says in the Middle Ages it was universally accepted for single women no longer to go to mikvah, and Judaism teaches there is nothing wrong with sex per se. It's as much part of our tzelem elokim as going to shul. Okay, what he was possibly advocating in that sentence will be the subject of a huge debate. You'll read it inside between now and next one. Why YU is producing our students with secular studies who keep ritual. We are not truly producing Jews in the heart. Today we are having a world in which the secular is very separate from our Jewish lives. And on top of it, Yeshiva College is a cultural backwater which needs improvement. He understands that President Belkin is trying to shift the emphasis to Yeshiva College in order to make it a better place and a little less on the Yeshiva. Okay, that was not seen as a controversial statement. But he still thinks we need a lot more work on the Yeshiva itself. So, for example, he repeatedly asked to teach Jewish intellectual history, and they kept telling him to stick to only American history because Jewish intellectual history opens up problems that would have to be addressed. I'm trying to remember who told him that. Yeah, I'm trying to remember who the higher up actually told him. But they eventually did let him teach Musar movement. And he used Rav Weinberg, the Sri Aisha's account of the Musar movement as his basis for the course. I'm trying to remember who told him, but I know he was forever fighting to teach Jewish subjects, and the answer is Jewish subjects really should be kept out of the college. Yes.
When did they get let in?
When did they get let in? Are we supposed to tell people they were let in? The answer is they were. What? The answer is there was a point in 1980s when a lot of the old time survey rabbis stopped teaching, meaning you're forgetting who's teaching now, but there were even more old time rabbis teaching Jewish history, that they quickly needed Carmi and Bernstein to fill in with intellectual history, and then the rest is history. Jewish intellectual history. Okay, that was the opening. Now, there is then going, I'm going to spend one more point before we go on, because it'll help you understand Greenberg's response. Greenberg will respond, that was April 66. Greenberg responds May of 66. Know that between 65 and the late 70s, there was a radical right at YU. That were Talmidim of the Rav that used to ban all philosophy in secular classes and said that the Rav was entirely halachic. They are the ones who used to harass both Yitz Greenberg and Rav Aaron Lichtenstein as wasting time on secular studies. They used to present halacha as the Rav is only halacha. They used to have handouts in front of First Hall, protests. The commentator has a few brief articles which have yet to be reprinted on them. And they are the ones responsible for defacing the 71 yearbook Masmid, all the Professor Berger articles saying that Jewish studies is kfira, and therefore we're going to completely blacken out his article in every issue of the yearbook.
Everywhere.
So that... they were, some of them are now important pulpit rabbis. Not some of the real destructive people, but some of the people part of this chavra are now pulpit rabbis that we know by name, so I'm not going to name who's involved in this. But they would go around, and even people who would be philosophy majors because they thought that it would make them closer to the Rav, would then pull down signs for the philosophy club or outside lectures or anything like that because they thought it was entirely Bittul Torah. You must understand that there was a persecution of all the, see, if 63, 64, 65, there was a big thrust to go into modernity and there were all these creative college classes. 66, 67, 68 was an anti-thrust into the 70s. What? No. That's why there were activities at night. So when Rabbi Yitz Greenberg responds, know that he's responding to people who are actually standing out in front of First Hall, who are giving out flyers about his evils, and they'll do it about other figures too. Okay? We will continue with this next time, because by the end of this, our entire discussion of orthodoxy will be in a different place.